Welcome back, everyone, to the final day of the summer school. So today we'll have a bit of a change of gears, and the topics will be about computational approaches and out-of-equilibrium aspects of quantum matter. So we're very happy to have Frank Pohlmann as our first speaker from TU Munich. So Frank will be talking about MPS methods and 1D quantum systems. So Frank, whenever you're ready.
Sure. Thanks, Tim, for the introduction, and thanks to all organizers for putting together this nice program and for the opportunity to talk a little bit about matrix product states and one-dimensional quantum system, a topic that I am quite excited about. So, what I mainly want to convey, I mainly want to show in my talk today or in this lecture, is how we can use matrix product state to overcome the exponential complexity that we are facing when simulating quantum many-body problems. So the setup is quite general. So we want to look at quantum many-body system. So that could be a quantum spin system, it could be a Hubbard-type model, so whatever kind of model comes to your mind, and the generic many-body state in such a Hilbert space can be expressed in this form, right? So we have now a generic wave function psi, which is expressed in terms of a simple basis. So it's a now we have a system of L sites, and each site has a local basis J n. N is going from 1 to d, right? So for a simple spin 1/2 system, Jn would be spin up or spin down, and for a spin 1 system is be for example the z basis minus 1, 0, and 1. For a Hubbard model, it would be an empty site, a site occupied by a spin up, site occupied by a spin down, or a doubly occupied site. And then d would be 4. So this is now the most generic way how we can express our many-body states, and this is what's done when we are using exact diagonalization as a tool, where we just store this object here. So we just store the amplitudes of the many-body state, but that's a beast, right? So this is something that grows where basically you have to store exponentially many complex numbers, and then we just don't get very far just to kind of show the numbers. So if we were to look at a spin 1/2 system, we still easily can do 10 spins on basically every computer. 20 spins still works on most somewhat larger computers, but then once we go beyond 20, it's already getting quite challenging. If you just look at what we can do a second, if we are interested in actually kind of completely diagonalizing the Hamiltonian, basically if we want to get the full spectrum on moderately large computers, we can just go up to 20 or so sites without playing extra tricks. And if we are only interested, for example, in a few of the eigenstates, so for example, if we are only interested in the ground state, we can use iterative, like for example, Lanczos or generic sparse methods, and that brings us up to 40 or so sites. But this is often not large enough, right? Because especially if we want to look at certain scaling properties, or if we want to investigate systems where the states generally have a longer correlation length. So, and what I want to talk about today is like now how we can use so-called matrix product states to efficiently compress quantum many-body states. I want to already kind of say what we are aiming at, or what we are arriving at, is that we want to find an approximation of the amplitudes of our wave function in terms of a product of these matrices, right? So each of those A's here is now a matrix for every physical index. Right, so basically, after we multiplied all these matrices together, then we get the amplitude of a given basis state in this expansion. So I'm gonna say more about this in a moment. But if we if we kind of do have this kind of approximation of our many body wave function, we actually achieved something quite great, because what we then have achieved that instead of having to store d, like d being the local dimension to the power of l, complex numbers, to just storing l times d times chi squared. And chi is now the letter that I always use for the dimension of these matrices. Right? In the simplest case, chi is 1, so then this is just a simple product state. So, and the good news is, like, once we find a representation of our many-body wave function in terms of an MPS, we are basically done. So at that moment, we can extract almost everything from it exactly. So, and in the first part of my talk, I actually want to discuss a little bit why is this actually a good approximation and when. So what are the conditions for this to be a good representation? In the second and third part, I then want to introduce two different algorithms that allow us to work with these matrix product states. In particular, the time evolving block decimation algorithm is an algorithm that allows us to perform both real and imaginary time evolution on matrix product states. And the density matrix renormalization group method is a tool which is a variational optimization of the energy within the manifold of matrix product states. So let me now start with the first part and try to demonstrate why matrix product states are a very useful tool for many of the problems that we are interested in one-dimensional systems. So once again, we are generically interested in a many-body wave function, which we can expand in terms of some local basis. Right? And for concreteness, the easiest thing is to just have in mind a simple spin one half system where each of these Jn is just say a spin up or a spin down. And then we have here these amplitudes in the many body wave function. So now I want to introduce the concept of a Schmidt decomposition. And for this, we do the following. So we are now interested in our one dimensional system. So like the one sketched here, where we have now these sides aligned on a one-dimensional chain. And we can now form a bipartition of the system as shown here by this dashed line. This dashed line is now separating the system into a left part A and a right part B. And now what we can do is we can take our many-body wave function and expand it in a basis I describing everything on the left and a basis J describing everything on the right. And then we have this coefficient matrix Cij, right? So we did nothing but just relabeling these guys, that's reshaping basically this rank L tensor. Now, what we can do is we can perform a singular value decomposition of this coefficient matrix. And this gives us a so-called Schmidt decomposition. So basically now what we have is a decomposition of our state in terms of product states, right? So now we have new basis states alpha A, which are an orthogonal basis for A, and basis states alpha B, which are an orthogonal basis for subsystem B. And in this basis, this coefficient matrix is diagonal. And then we have here the so-called Schmidt values lambda alpha. And this is very closely related to something that you've already seen in several lectures throughout this week. And this is directly related to the entanglement entropy. So in particular, the entanglement entropy as a measure for the amount of entanglement for a given bipartition is actually directly given in terms of these Schmidt values, right? So the entanglement entropy is given by minus the sum of alpha lambda alpha squared times log lambda alpha squared. In fact, in a few lines, you can show that if you construct the reduced density matrix using this decomposition, that the reduced density matrix is diagonal in this basis, right? So the Schmidt states are actually the eigenstates of the reduced density matrix. Good. So what we have done is we just take our many-body wave function, we form a bipartition into a left part and a right part, and we introduce the Schmidt decomposition. And next, I want to discuss why this is interesting. So let us now not look at a generic many-body wave function, but we are now interested in a ground state of a local and gapped Hamiltonian. Right. So this is a restriction, but it's still, this includes now many of the Hamiltonians we find interesting and that we might want to study. And local and gapped Hamiltonians, they fulfill the an area law. And the area law means that the entropy of a subsystem scales not with the volume of a subsystem, so it's not thermal, but instead it only scales with the perimeter of the cut. And in the special case of a one-dimensional system, the perimeter of this cut is just a constant, right? Because if we just make the partition longer, or in our case here, if we make the system larger, the cut is not getting larger. So the cut is just simply a zero-dimensional object. So now we have states where for which the entanglement entropy will not depend on the system size if we just cut our system into two halves as shown here. Obviously, if L is much smaller than the correlation length, we will see a growth, but the moment that our L is large compared to the correlation length, this will converge to a constant. And here I try to show some intuitive picture for why we get this area law, because if we have a ground state, you would see that there are lots of local quantum fluctuations. For example, spins that are nearby, for them it's energetically useful to form a singlet, but states that are very far away, they are much less entangled. So if we just now add more and more sites to the system, we actually see that not much entanglement is added to the system. So good. So now we have kind of at this kind of level, I'm shown now the area law for one dimensional system that S of L is constant. And let me also point out that for the one dimensional case, this actually has been proven by Hastings a few years ago. And for higher dimensional systems where we have an area law of maybe S of L would be proportional to L in two dimensions, that's there's no generic proof for this to be true for local and gapped Hamiltonians. So why is this, why are we happy about this? So we're happy about this because the fact that we have this theorem that all ground states of local and gapped Hamiltonians have an area law restricts our kind of manifold in which our states live to a very tiny corner, right? So basically in this schematic, I just draw this big box, like this big box here contains now our 2 to the L states for a spin 1/2 system. So this is the volume spanned by 2 to the L states. So this is huge, but there's now a very tiny corner in this huge volume in which all the area law all the area law states live. But this is a vanishing corner because there's only a kind of a zero, like the set of area law states in this huge volume is only of measure zero, right? So there's now in this huge Hilbert space, there's a very tiny corner in which we have the area law states lie. And that is now very good news when we are interested in finding the ground states, because we can forget basically about the entire Hilbert space. So we can forget about almost the entire volume of the Hilbert space. We just have to focus on this tiny corner. So that's the first good news, that because of this theorem, we know exactly where to look for the ground state of our local and gapped Hamiltonian. And this is true now for any local and gapped Hamiltonian. So if you're looking at a spin system or a system of fermions or whatnot, it's always in this tiny corner. So that's the first good news. But there's now another very good news, and this is now directly related to the Schmidt decomposition that I brought up earlier. So let us now first do the following. So we first take some random state, like a random state, we just pick randomly somewhere from this Hilbert space. And in fact, if I randomly pick a state in this Hilbert space, I will actually get with a probability one a volume law state, or it will be a even like a maximally entangled state. And if I now take this state and I form my Schmidt decomposition, so now I do exactly what I just discussed before, namely now I expand my wave function in a superposition of product states as shown here. And now I plot the Schmidt values, right? So I take a sufficiently large system, I do a bipartition into two halves as shown here. And now I plot the squares of my of the Schmidt coefficients. And for those I know that because of the wave function is normalized, it those sum up to one. But what I see here is that so I ordered them according to their size, and they're all roughly of the same size, at least the dominant ones. So, and what I know from this is that if I expand it, I basically have to take into account all of those states in order to get a good approximation of the wave function. If, however, instead of taking a random state, I take now a ground state, so I take a ground state in this case of the Ising model, a state that actually lies in this manifold of area law states, then I find that a completely different picture. In particular, I see that there are a few dominant Schmidt values that that are of order one, or like that they are significantly large, and then they decay extremely rapidly. And here we see that if we take into account only, say, the order of 20 or so of the largest Schmidt values, we capture almost the entire weight of the wave function. And that's now a very, very good second good news, that those area law states generically have this kind of nice property that we can just compress states by performing a Schmidt decomposition and then keeping only a few of those Schmidt values. So, and to illustrate this a bit better, we can now do some sort of a visual experiment. So previously I said that, well, we have a many-body wave function, and for this many-body wave function, or the many-body wave function, we can express this coefficient matrix for some generic orthogonal basis I for A and orthogonal basis J for B, and then we do a Schmidt decomposition. Or in other words, what we're doing is we just take the coefficient matrix and perform a singular value decomposition. And here we have the singular values lambda. But instead of these coefficient matrix Cij to represent a quantum state, we can also think of this coefficient matrix to represent some image, right? So for example, they can represent the Golden Gate Bridge. And then the representation is such that a small number here represents a dark pixel in the picture, and a larger number represents a brighter pixel. And now we can do exactly what we were playing before for the quantum states. We can now reconstruct the full image by and truncate the information basically by keeping only the dominant singular values, right? So if we just multiply these matrices that we get from the singular value decomposition, a diagonal matrix lambda times V, and we keep only here the dominant singular values, then we just get again a full picture, but we've just projected out some of the information. And then we can just look at it and by eye judge how good this approximation is. So what we did here is now we just take this picture that we just saw of the Golden Gate Bridge, which has on the smaller dimension 1,200 pixel. And now we perform the singular value decomposition and then reconstruct it by keeping only the four dominant singular values. And here it's like quite blurry and we don't really see much. If you take 16 out of 1,200, we already get an idea that this might be a bridge, and then now successively more and more details are added to this picture. But this is now basically a way how we can compress the information. So we just throw away the information corresponding to the smaller singular values, and we only keep the dominant ones. And to actually show, to relate this to the to area law states, we can actually now think of different images, right? So because here for this one, we see that if we take few of the states, the original image is just quite crappy, and we don't see many of the details which are actually contained in the image. But how well it works really depends on what kind of image we take. If you, for example, take these paintings by Mondrian, and we take this one here on the left, which has a 500 times 500 pixel. So for in order to represent it exactly, we need 500 pixel. However, in this case, just a single, we just only, if we just keep only a single singular value, we actually can reconstruct this image, right? So in other words, there's really little information in these paintings. Good. And now we want to, maybe is it a good point to pause for a moment if there are some questions that came up?
I think we're good for now, but if anyone has questions, maybe you can raise your hand right now. Yayun Hu, you can go ahead.
Yeah, I have a question. So earlier you mentioned that the matrix product states have exponentially decay weights if we look at the corner, the ground state only. However, it seems that for the picture example, for the bridge example, it seems how does the bridge relate to a ground state? Is there
right? So that's a good point. So the bridge does not belong to a ground state because, in fact, if you want to play this in these on, if you look on Slack, I put one of the tutorials which actually. In which you can play this game, and then you're actually going to see it. If you take a larger and larger images with more and more detail, you actually need to represent more and more. You need to keep into account more Schmidt values, and in fact, the entropy or the important entanglement entropies that you want to look at, in particular the so-called Renyi entropies with index smaller than one, they actually have a volume law for a generic image. So generic images do not fall into this category of states that can be represented efficiently. That's why I showed this picture of Mondrian here, because in this picture, it doesn't matter how much you scale it up, you will always be able to represent it, in this case, even like very well as a product state, or at least as a very good approximation with this small bond image. So the bridge would not correspond to an area law state, but Mondrian would.
Okay, I see. Thank you.
Okay, thanks, Frank. I think you can continue.
Okay, good. Right. So basically, what we're gonna see in a few, I think, important things. So basically, that ground states fulfill an area law, and by this, all ground states live in a small corner, and that corner has this. In this corner, the states have the property that the Schmidt values decay sufficiently fast that we can truncate them and by this compress the state. But the question, like, how can we do this in practice? Because now if we have a many-body wave function, we can now basically successively apply these singular value decomposition or Schmidt decompositions, and by this compress the state. And for this, I want to introduce now some diagrammatic representation, which is quite commonly used whenever working with these matrix or generically tensor product states, is the following. So as I said, that the many-body wave function, we think of a rank or an order L tensor, which means we have like now L, like some object with L indices. And for the next slide, what I'm going to use, I use this kind of graphic notation where I say that the tensor is just represented by this blob, and each of those indices is just represented by some line sticking out of this block. And now what I can do is I can do successively these Schmidt decompositions. So I start with my full wave function, which is an order L tensor. And now I perform a Schmidt decomposition on the first bond and decompose it into, in this case, I get a rank 2 tensor. And then we have here just like the remainder. And then we just go to the next bond, to the next bond, to the next bond, until we have played this game at every bond. And this is an exact transformation if we keep into account all the Schmidt values, right? If we kind of follow this procedure that I outlined here, and we just don't throw away any Schmidt value, or we keep all the Schmidt states in these summations, this is just an exact transformation. This is just a quite cumbersome representation of a many body state, but it's exact. But the beauty of this is now is that at every step, we can actually just throw away the small Schmidt values. And by this, we have then at the end compressed the state into a matrix product state. So in the end, after following through this kind of procedure, we have exactly, we brought our state, or the amplitudes in the state are now expressed in the form as we advertised in the very beginning. Namely, we just express our rank L tensor as a product of many rank 3 tensors. So, and these states are those kind of tailored to describe one-dimensional systems within area law. So, and let me now say a few kind of practical things about matrix product states. Because so far, what I wanted to show is that we do have an efficient representation of many-body wave functions in this form. And I just showed a quite not so practical way of achieving it, because at the moment we just assume we are still powerful enough to represent the full wave function, which we can then compress to a more efficient representation. But before actually showing algorithms that allow us to work directly and only in this this manifold, I want to show a few properties of these matrix product states that will be very helpful for working with them. So what we have is we are now expressing the amplitudes in our many-body wave function in terms of this product of these matrices. And using this diagrammatic notation that I just came up with, it's this form. So each of these triangles is now a rank or order 3 tensor. And on the horizontal lines, we just having the matrix multiplication. And on the vertical, we have the physical indices that remain as after the contraction. So, and just to make life a bit easier, I just assume that the matrix product state is translation invariant, so we have the same matrix everywhere, just to draw things in a less confusing way. So now one of the observations that we make is that a matrix product state representation is not unique. In particular, if we just have some amplitudes in a many-body wave function described by some matrix A, right? So if we just multiply these matrices A together, then we just get the amplitude of a given state. We see that if we just instead look at, change the matrices by just multiplying them on the left, on the right with some invertible matrix X, right? So if we have some new matrix product states made out of these tensors A tilde, which are given by X times A times X inverse, then you see that these matrices describe exactly the same state, right? Because the X and X, X inverse, they cancel each other. So we have a huge kind of gauge degree of freedom when talking about matrix product states. And we are going to use this kind of freedom to our advantage by bringing the matrix product states into a quite convenient form. And this is a so-called canonical form. And what we want to do is we actually want to bring the matrix product state into a form such that each of the indices that we have, or each of the so-called the horizontal or the virtual indices or bonds correspond to directly to the Schmidt decomposition, right? So now we just decompose our matrices in terms of a product of diagonal matrices that contain the Schmidt values and some order three tensors gamma, which relate the local basis and the Schmidt basis, right? So then we express the amplitude in our many-body wave function in this form where we have now gamma, lambda, gamma, lambda. And these are now the original A matrices in this form. And we have now chosen these A in such a form that if we now contract everything, so we just pick a given bond here, and if we just multiply all the matrices to the left of our bond, right? So we just keep this alpha here fixed to some value. We just multiply all the matrices to the left of this bond. Then we get the left Schmidt state. If we just keep some index alpha fixed and we just multiply all the matrices starting with the gamma matrix to the right, then we get the right Schmidt states. And these Schmidt states are chosen in such a form, as we discussed very early on, that they are forming an orthogonal basis. And this means that that these kind of Schmidt states are orthogonal. And here we now use again these kind of graphical representation to represent this product of the two Schmidt states, right? So this is now for the right Schmidt states. So we just keep some index alpha fixed. If we just multiply all these guys to the right, we get alpha r. And if we just keep this one fixed to alpha prime, then we get Schmidt states alpha prime. And by contracting all the physical indices, what I'm doing here, this is exactly the scalar product of A prime and A, or alpha prime and alpha. And these are orthogonal. So this forms now an identity matrix. And this is now a very helpful property, because if we want to calculate some observable now, and now again using this this graphical representation, so we represent our wave function as shown here as a product of these tensors. Now we act on our state with some operator O on a given site. So this is just like some simple operator acting on a single site. So now we have O times psi. And now we just calculate the expectation value. So now we just multiply the as a bra from below. And this is now the expectation value. And in a generic state, what we would have to do is to just multiply everything from the left and everything from the right. And then we just so we have just to do all these contractions in this matrix product state. However, we have this nice property that these kind of states are orthogonal, right? So basically, as I showed earlier, if we have a state alpha and alpha prime, this is an orthogonal state, so it just forms the identity matrix. So now we can just successively apply this, this trick and, oops, sorry. So we can now successively apply this identity, and then we can see that we can calculate the observable just in this very local way, right? So all we have to calculate is this contraction of these local tensors, and then we can see what, for example, the magnetization of our state would be, or if we just use two sites, for example, we could show what is the energy of the state with respect to some Heisenberg Hamiltonian and whatnot. So just to repeat briefly what I did, so we have these matrix product states And these matrix product states have a gauge degree of freedom, which we can use to our advantage by bringing into this canonical form. And we just choose a canonical form in such a way that if we cut an MPS at a given bond, we just directly have access to the Schmidt decomposition, right? So just multiplying everything to the left of a bond gives us the Schmidt states for the left. If we just multiply all the majors on the right, we just get the Schmidt states to the right. And in the center, we have then the diagonal matrix with the Schmidt values. And having this form allows us to very efficiently calculate observables because we just need to contract the local tensors that we have around our site where we want to calculate the expectation value. Similarly, we can do it for correlation functions. Then if we just want to look at a correlation function between maybe site I or site M and site N, then we just can contract everything from the left to M and everything on the right to N. These are just using the identities that I've just shown. And then we just have to calculate this kind of object in between. And here we have these transfer matrices defined, right? So basically we just get a right vector to which we have to apply the transfer matrix a few times, and then we just multiply it with the left vector. Good. So this is all I wanted to say about these matrix product states, where I hope that I could convince you that matrix product states are a very useful tool to represent a class of states that we are very much interested in. And these are the area law states. And I've shown some tools or some nice properties of these matrix product states that allow for efficient evaluation of observables. What I've not shown is how to actually use them for something practical, right? So because at the moment, I just shown that states can be represented, right? So that these states are good to represent states that we're interested in, but I haven't really shown how to obtain them. Because problems that we are usually interested in is that we, for example, have some Hamiltonian and we want to find what the ground state is. Or we have a Hamiltonian and we want to understand how a state evolves under unitary evolution with respect to a given Hamiltonian. So these are questions that we want to address, and I want to show how this can actually be done using different algorithms. So the first algorithm that I want to introduce is now the time-evolving block decimation. But before I start, maybe are there any questions?
Frank, there's one question maybe you want to elaborate a bit on. So it's from Christian Chung. And the question is, within the area law space, do we know that the Schmidt values decay exponentially or some similar heuristic?
I mean, there's a rigorous statement in a paper by Norbert Schuch from maybe 2006, I forgot the exact time, but there he proves that every state that has an area law state for a Renyi entropy with an index smaller than one, those can be represented efficiently in terms of a matrix product state, which means that that we can truncate the Schmidt spectrum at a finite value and get an exponentially good approximation of the state for local observables. So I think this is a statement.
Okay, thanks. That's it for now.
Okay. So let us now agree on, or at least hope that these matrix product states are now a good manifold to look at, and let us now explore some algorithms that allows us to manipulate these states. And now I want to make a few restrictions. So for now, I want to assume that my Hamiltonian can be expressed in this form. So I want to assume that my Hamiltonian can be expressed as a sum of local terms, which only act between neighboring sites, right? So we have sum over j, h, j, and j plus one, right? So this is now a term acting between neighboring sites. And this could be, for example, be a Heisenberg Hamiltonian or like some Ising Hamiltonian. And for this kind of type of Hamiltonian, the algorithm will work to do, on the one hand, time evolution in real time. So we just start from some initial state and we can evolve it under a unitary evolution. And on the second, we can do evolution in imaginary time. And by this, we have then a tool to perform, to find the ground state of a Hamiltonian, for example. So there are a few steps that we, a few sort of relatively simple steps that we are going through. So we first take our Hamiltonian H and we decompose it into two parts, F and G. And the part F includes only terms acting on even bonds, right? So if we have now our one-dimensional system shown here, so now we have terms F that acts on even bonds, and we have the term G that acts on odd bonds. So clearly, all terms in F commute because they don't have any kind of sites in common on which they would act on. And similarly, all terms in G commute, but F and G do not commute. So this is now the basis for a so-called Suzuki Trotter decomposition. Namely, we can then expand our exponential in terms of a certain order of a Trotter decomposition. Like in the lowest order, we can just expand it as e to the minus I delta t times f times e to the minus I delta t times g, and this is then of the error of this for this expansion would be of the order of delta t squared. So we see that if we just choose a particularly sufficiently small delta t, then this becomes a very good approximation of the time evolution. So, and then this is actually quite convenient because if we do the Trotter decomposition of our time evolution operator, then we can expand our, or then we can write our time evolution as kind of two chains of two side gates, right? So we just first apply the operator on only even bonds, right? So this is now an exact rewriting of our time evolution in terms of F, because all terms at F commute. And then the next layer, we just evolve all odd bonds with terms G. Again, this is an exact expression because all terms in G commute. And each of those gates affects the state only locally. So now we have kind of cut down our problem quite a bit. So because what we want to do is we want to time evolve our matrix product state. And what we are doing is now we just write down our matrix product state at a time t using this canonical form as we just described. And now we just have our U matrices that we that act on say now the even bonds. And now what we need to do is we need to have an algorithm that gets us back to this matrix product state form. And the nice thing is, as I said before, that these U's act only locally on the state. We just need to figure out an algorithm that does it for a given bond, right? So once we do it for this bond, we can just apply the same trick successively on all bonds. And this is now done by the time evolving block decimation algorithm. So we bring, what we're doing is we just take out a piece of our state, like of a subset of our tensors here, and we just take them out in such a way that this expression that I'm shown here, this expression theta is now a representation of a wave function in a mixed representation. Like everything left is described in terms of the Schmidt states, right? So because this is, so we remember that if we just multiply all the tensors left of a bond starting with a gamma, we get the Schmidt states to the left. And the same for the right, if we just multiply all the tensors to the right of this bond starting with a gamma, then we get the Schmidt states on the right. And here we have now the local basis, right? So now we have an expression of, or again, a representation of our many-body wave function in a mixed basis, where we have Schmidt states to the left, Schmidt states to the right, and we have now the local basis I and J here, right? So we have now an expression in terms of some orthogonal basis. Once we have it in this form, we can now perform the time evolution of the wave function on this bond by just multiplying this guy, and this gives us a new theta tilde. So this is now the wave function where we time evolved on a given bond. But now, since it's in an orthogonal represent, like it's represented with respect to some orthogonal basis, we can now perform a Schmidt decomposition as we did before. And now we get the new Schmidt values, lambda gamma, lambda tilde. And from the rest, like from the kind of from the Schmidt states here, we can then directly extract the new the updated gammas, right? So, and now this kind of simple algorithm we can apply to every even bond first, and next we can apply it to every odd bond, and by this we can perform the time evolution. And we see that at this point, right? So if we do the time evolution this way without doing any truncation, then we would see that at this step here, the bond dimension will grow, because here we had, say, bond dimension chi, here we had a local dimension d, and after doing this singular value decomposition, we would find generically d times chi non-zero Schmidt values. But here at this stage, we just truncated back to the bond dimension that we can handle, and by this kind of stay in a manageable size of a Hilbert of the space. And there's one further nice trick, is that if we have a system which is translation invariant and infinite, like here, for example, with a two-side unit cell where we have matrices gamma A, lambda A, gamma B, lambda B, and this just keeps repeating, then we can do each step in parallel, right? So because if we do an update here on the even bond, we can do it on this bond, but it will be exactly the same on all other even bonds. So we only have to do it once. And similarly for the odd bonds, once we do an update on the odd bonds, we do it simultaneously for all odd bonds, which means effectively we only have to do these updates on two bonds. So what I wanted to show now is I want actually to quickly kind of demonstrate how this algorithm works. And I want to look at a fairly simple one-dimensional model, namely the quantum Ising model. So for the quantum Ising model, which we probably, I'm sure everyone has seen, we have now the Ising coupling between neighboring spins, and we have a transverse field. And as we tune this, the ratio of G over J, the system undergoes a phase transition from an ordered ferromagnetic phase into a disordered paramagnetic phase. And now I want to look at an Python implementation of what we just learned. So we can implement this in Colab on Google. And here, what I've let me just restart. So we first load just some standard kind of Python libraries that all come when you install whatever Python. And now we have a few sort of subroutines. There's like a simple subroutine which is initializing the matrix product state with a simple ferromagnet. So a ferromagnet is a simple product state. We initiate the two-side unitaries that we had, or the gates acting on neighboring sites, which are just the e to the minus delta t times the Hamiltonian on a given bond. And I have short functions which calculate, for example, bond expectation values exactly the same way as we just showed, assuming that the state is in the canonical form. We have site expectation values. We can extract the entanglement entropy, which we can directly read off from the Schmidt values, and a function which is calculating the correlation length, which we can directly read off from the transfer matrix that I defined earlier on. So, and here this is now the core routine. So what we see here, this is now the entire TEBD algorithm. So these are now exactly the steps that we looked at before. So we have these different steps. So the first step is that we contract these tensors together so that we have this mixed representation of our wave function as I described. And we also already multiply the matrix U. So these lines are just combining step one and two. Then we just perform a Schmidt decomposition. So this is step number three. And here we're doing the truncation. So we keep only a chi number of Schmidt values. And that's it. So now we just retrieve the updated tensors, right? So these few lines are the entire TVD algorithm for doing the time evolution. So now we should be able to just start it. So and then we can run it as performing the imaginary time evolution. And we just first start with a relatively large time step to move far, but then we have then the trotter error that I mentioned earlier is large. And then we just successively reduce these time steps. And then we can compare to the exact solution of the Ising model. And we see that after a few seconds, we just get the ground state correctly as the accuracy of 10 to the minus 10. So these kind of, you find links to these tutorials on the Slack page, and then you're all welcome to play around with with this code. And you can, for example, check the phase diagram of the Ising model. Good. So this is now the time evolving block decimation algorithm as one tool. And I want to now in the remainder of my talk discuss another algorithm. This is called density matrix renormalization group algorithm. The density matrix renormalization group method, actually as introduced originally by Stephen White in the 90s, without knowing the connection to matrix product states, is actually an algorithm that variationally finds the ground state within the manifold of matrix product states. And it has a number of advantages when it comes to finding ground state. So it's actually converging much faster than the TBD algorithm for ground states. It directly can be applied to systems which actually have some longer range or long range interactions. But the many of the key ideas, for example, this kind of trick that I showed that we can directly work in the thermodynamic limit also applies to this DMIG algorithm. All we need to do is we need to introduce one other concept, and this is now a generalization of matrix product states to operators. So conceptually, it's not much going on. It's just basically instead of having states where we have only indices I1 through IL, we now have operators where we have indices I1 through IL and I1 prime to I1 IL prime. And then we can use this graphical notation, and now we have just two indices coming out, some up on the top and some going to the bottom. And these are now operators acting on our Hilbert space. And now we can just act with these matrix product operators or MPOs on a matrix product state. And we can also calculate expectation values of a given matrix product state. Like of the operator with respect to a given, so we can just calculate expectation values in this form. So this is like a direct generalization of matrix product states to the space of operators. And the nice thing is that, for example, Hamiltonians, or like, for example, the Heisenberg Hamiltonian or Ising model, the one that we just looked at, they can be very easily and exactly represented in terms of matrix product operators with fairly small bond dimensions. So, and what we then want to do is actually we want to variationally minimize the energy. So basically, we can write down, we just first represent our Hamiltonian in terms of a matrix product operator as shown here. And now we just have a first guess of our wave function, like of our matrix product state. And now we just can basically take out some of these matrices. And then we have now a representation of our Hamiltonian in this kind of Schmidt basis again. And we can now just diagonalize this Hamiltonian and find now a better guess for A and then move to the next site and so on. And in this spirit, it's then very similar to what we are doing in the TEBD algorithm. So let me just demonstrate this similarity by actually not taking out two matrices, not taking out just one matrix, but by taking out two matrices. Then we just go again to the mixed representation as shown before. So this step is exactly the same step as what we did for the TEBD algorithm. And now starting from this state, we can now iteratively find a ground state representation of the Hamiltonian in this basis. So this is now the Hamiltonian projected onto this effective basis, right? So it's again the Hamiltonian represented in a mixed basis of local space, local basis for sites I and J, and the Schmidt basis for everything on the left, and the Schmidt basis for everything on the right. So now we can use whatever iterative eigensolver like Lanczos or Arnoldi to find the dominant eigenvector, or to find the ground state of this this effective Hamiltonian, which is now our theta tilde. And this is now the only difference that we have compared to the TEBD algorithm, because now the next steps are identical because we just perform a singular value decomposition and truncate it and then get the updated state in this canonical form. And then we just move to the next bond, right? So this is one thing that I think is nice pointing out, that these algorithms are very similar. It's just that there's this one step two that where we replace the imaginary time evolution by iteratively finding the ground state of this Hamiltonian in the mixed basis. So let me now in the remaining few minutes just point out some practical tools for actually performing these algorithms, because while conceptually this algorithm is very simple, there are quite a few tweaks one can use to make it faster. So for example, for systems that have conserved quantities, we can use conserved quantities. And also we want to ideally use efficient tools for diagonalizing the Hamiltonian, etc. And it is mostly driven by a former student of mine, by Johannes Hauschild, who is now postdoc at Berkeley. We developed a tensor package that includes all these algorithms that I talked about. And using these kind of package, these generic matrix product state simulations can be then done fairly easily. So we can just use Python again. We just import a few packages. We can then define a model, just giving parameters like the system size, like the number of sites, and the coupling parameters. We can define an initial state. For example, we can just choose a simple product state where all spins up. We can choose parameters for the DMRG simulations, like here the bond dimension, chi set to 30, and the truncation parameters for the truncation. And then we can just run the DMRG and from this extract, like for example, the energy. And let me here again show briefly the tutorial for this that you're all welcome to play with. So this is again running on CoLab, And what we have is now we just can first on Colab install this TenPy package, which should run seamlessly. And then we import certain packages for the Ising model, for example. And yeah, we just set the parameters as just advertised. And for this, we can then we just choose here the transverse field Ising model. We choose a specific initial state, the parameters for the DMRG simulations. And then we can just calculate various observables. For example, here again, the magnetization, the entanglement entropy, the bond dimension. And then we can again compare it to the exact result. And then we're going to find like in a fraction of a second that we actually get here then to machine precision, right? So even like with a very small bond dimension of 10, we just reach machine precision for the ground state of the Ising model for those parameters here. Good. So Tim, what about time? I mean, is there now some discussion time or do I still have time to talk?
That's up to you. So you have about 11 minutes till the end of the session and you can decide how much you want to answer questions or keep going.
Or maybe I very briefly show one other example for where I think these kind of tensor products, they have MPS works quite well. And this is for the study of, for example, symmetry protected topological phases. And just to show like an example, which is a bit less trivial than the Ising model that I looked at before. So here we have the Haldane phase described by that's characterized by these half integer spins residing at the edges of an open chain. And these can be classified in terms of, for example, in the presence of certain symmetries, in terms of projective representations. So that we have, for example, for spin rotations, we can have a linear representation in the bulk, but the edge spins transform projectively under these symmetries. And there's like a big scheme to classify them. And one of the models where we do find a transition between different SPT phases is a spin one Heisenberg chain. So we just have, again, we have a Heisenberg coupling between neighboring spins plus a single ion anisotropy like this D term, like sum over SZ squared. And then we just know that if D is zero, it's in the so-called Haldane phase. And if D is very large, we're in a so-called large D phase, which is adiabatically connected to a simple product state. So in this case, it's a model that cannot be solved exactly. And we actually rely on numerical methods. And the way that we can distinguish these phases is, for example, by calculating non-local order parameters, or we can look at the so-called entanglement spectrum. So the entanglement spectrum are the Schmidt values that we looked at before. And that's now quite practical because in these DMRG simulations, we have direct access to the Schmidt values, right? Because through this algorithm, we always calculate the Schmidt values. So we can directly look at the entanglement spectrum. And this is now here's the like another example where we can now use this TenPy package for studying the spin one chain. So we again choose now a bond dimension. We choose the model parameters for the spin one Heisenberg chain. So we choose isotropic coupling like Jx, Jy, and Jz. And we choose the single ion anisotropy D. But we define the model. We define now an antiferromagnetic initial state. Here we just pass the parameters to the DMRG algorithm. And then we can directly get the entanglement spectrum. And here's just plotted in this way so that we directly see that in this Haldane phase, which we have for D equals to zero, we actually see here that every Schmidt value is twofold degenerate as one of the characteristic properties of this Haldane phase. If we then go to some larger D, which then we should see that the degeneracies are no longer present. Now we see that they are not here, and this is like now one way to spot basically where a transition happens between the large D phase and the Haldane phase. Good. Yeah, so let me then conclude here. So what I wanted to do, I mean, it was a bit of a dense talk, I guess, but what I wanted to show is in the first part, I wanted to convince you that these matrix product states are a very useful tool to describe certain states that we are quite interested in when simulating one-dimensional quantum systems. So in particular, I just showed that area law states can be represented nicely, and area law states are relevant in the context of ground states of local and gapped Hamiltonians. However, it turns out that these states go beyond it. So even states where we have logarithmic corrections, they cannot be described in the thermodynamic limit, but they are still fairly good approximations. But going to these details would have taken too long. And secondly, I only talked here about ground states, but we can also learn quite a bit from time evolutions, like from real-time evolutions of matrix product states, which in certain cases also allow to go to large times, in particular when systems exhibit, for example, many-body localization, or if we do quenches with zero energy densities and so on. So there's lots to say about it, but I don't have the time. And then I just introduced two quite popular algorithms, the time-evolving block decimation algorithm, allowing for real and imaginary time evolution, and the density matrix randomization group method for efficiently finding ground states. So, and, whoever is interested, I mean, I suggest to have a look at these different tutorials where we can explore both the transverse field Ising model and the spin one kind of SPT phase. Good, then let me stop here, and I'm happy to take questions.
Okay, thanks, Frank, for the very clear talk. So there's one literally open question in the Q&A from Tiha Kia. He or she asks, is it possible to apply TBD algorithm for open quantum system simulations?
Yes, so we can also look at, for example, some Lindblad and perform the same thing. So basically, what we can do for this open quantum system is that there are various ways of doing it, but one way of doing it would be that we just start from a density matrix. So we just instead of looking at a state like a pure quantum state, we just start from a density matrix described as in terms of an MPO, and now we can just apply the TBD algorithm directly. The TBD algorithm is then performing is simulating the super operator acting on the density matrix, and then the rest goes through identically. Right, so it's just equivalent to simulating a quantum state where we just have, instead of a local dimension d, we have a local dimension of d squared, and there are various papers discussing how to do this in detail. So yes.
Okay, thanks. So there's another question from Pontus Laurel in the Q&A. Are MPS, MPOs still useful in disordered systems?
Yes, so again, here, for the examples in the tutorial, in both cases, I'm using translation invariants. I'm assuming that we have an infinite system with a finite unit cell that repeats. However, generically, and for all these kind of algorithms, we don't need translation invariants. And in fact, it works in many ways, or in certain ways, in our favor. If, for example, we're doing the time evolution in a clean system, we always find that the entanglement entropy grows linearly and the corresponding bond dimension grows exponentially in time. If, however, we have a strongly disordered system that might many-body localize, then we would find that the Bondermenschen, was ist Bondermenschen Chi, no longer grows exponentially, but it can grow polynomially. So yes, and in fact, in many cases, disordered systems are actually easier to simulate using these tools than clean systems.
Okay, thanks. So next we have Michael Flynn raised his hand. Michael, you can go ahead.
Thank you very much, Frank, for the clear talk. I was wondering if you could talk to us about the prospects for going beyond area law states with DMRG, in particular for spin liquid systems. I know DMRG has been used to study some examples of those highly frustrated long-range entangled systems, but the justification for studying them is unclear to me, especially because everything seems to be built around these gapped short-range entangled states. What exactly are the prospects going forward for studying these highly frustrated long-range entangled states, in your opinion?
Wait, I mean, just to clarify a few things. So a generic spin liquid, if for example, take a Z2 spin liquid, we would still have an area law, but it would be a 2D area law, right? So now we are talking about 2D systems. Is this correct what you're talking about? Or you're talking about one-dimensional versions of a spin liquid, like the Heisenberg chain? I mean, what kind of spin liquid are you talking about?
Well, the first one that came to mind was your work on the Kagame antiferromagnet.
Right, okay, so for, because everything that I mean, that's also my title, it's at this moment, I only focused on one-dimensional quantum systems. So this is a good question that what can we just learn using this kind of tool about two-dimensional systems? And in fact, I think that at the moment, for these kind of highly frustrated systems that you are alluded to, the DMRG method is still one of the workhorses at the moment. The problem is that let me just go back to this one picture that I have early on. So here I made the point that we have an area law that if I just make my system longer in x direction, that the entanglement doesn't increase and thus the bond dimension is constant, right? So I can just go with L to infinity and the bond dimension that I need for a given accuracy is constant. If, however, I would have a two-dimensional system, then what I would find, if I would have a two-dimensional system with dimension Lx and Ly, what I would find is I can still find like a one-dimensional representation of my state. But then I would find that the entanglement entropy will grow linearly with Ly, for example. And that implies that the numerical effort or the bond dimension that is required grows exponentially with Ly. So in this way, this tool, it's still using kind of large computers and refined code. We can go to systems that are larger than what can be done with ED, but we can never reach a real 2D system. So the workaround is that we just look at cylinders of different widths. So we can never reach a real 2D system, but the trick is that we just look at quasi one-dimensional systems on cylinders which are as large as possible to mimic some two-dimensional physics. But there are strong caveats. And to overcome this, there are new proposals on using so-called generalized sort of tensor network states that can capture 2D states, but there are still kind of various technical problems that we have to deal with before this becomes a powerful tool for problems.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, well, thanks again, Frank, and thanks also to Aaron Satz and everyone else participating in the Q&A for addressing questions. Notice that today we have a longer break. It's 1.5 hours. We encourage you to check out the Remo interface. So Mike has conveniently reposted the link in your chat. We'll reconvene at 1:45 for the next talk. So see you then.